the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to an exciting episode of Arthropod, your entomology theme podcast. I'm Michael Scavarla at Penn State University, and today I'm joined by...
I'm Jonathan Larson at University of Nebraska.
Jody Green, also with University of Nebraska.
And Matt Bertone at NC State University.
Yay!
So thanks, Matt, for coming on to talk to us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no problem. It's should be really interesting. So Matt is an insect identifier at NC State, and I am the insect identifier at Penn State, so we should have some good conversations about identifying insects and differences between the institutions and entomology. Before we get into exactly what you're doing at NC State, I kind of wanted to get some of your backstory to get the audience introduced to you. So why are you interested in bugs? Have you always had an interest in insects and creepy crawly things as a kid? Was it a class during undergrad? How did you get into entomology begin with?
What's his origin story?
Yeah, what's your origin story?
Yeah, the why, I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly why. There's something with my brain. But I was actually interested from a very early age. Since at least five, probably since I could start looking at pictures and books and whatnot. So yes, I've always been interested in it. All my relatives are not at all surprised that I became an entomologist. And I grew up, I spent the first 5 years in New York City, which had a few arthropods around. I actually did have a yard and a tree, a couple of trees and things like that. And then I moved to outside of Philadelphia, where I grew up, where I had a little bit more outdoors experience. But yes, I've always loved arthropods in general. I went through a dinosaur phase a little bit, and I liked the reptiles a lot when I was younger, which I still do.
That's interesting that you went through a dinosaur phase, because I did too. And in you know, coming in at the end of high school, it was, do I want to be a paleontologist or an entomologist? I can't do both. Obviously, I went the entomology route because I like things that are alive, still follow paleontology Twitter pretty closely, and actually read dinosaur papers and things. So that's really neat that you went through that, too. I wonder if that's more widespread in entomology than we really talk about.
I thought all kids like dinosaurs, don't
they?
Yeah,
that's good.
I thought that was just a given.
Yeah, I like the weirder ones, and I also like some of the other prehistoric organisms, you know, not just the actual dinosaurs, but yeah, it was just too popular among the kids.
Too many kids. Are you a hipster entomologist? Too many kids like the dinosaurs, so you went with bugs?
I am actually a hipster entomologist still, and if a group gets too popular, I just abandon it usually, so.
So I guess that's a good lead into some of the past work that you've done. So digging into some of your publications, I see that you've done some dung beetle research at North Carolina, and that was more applied stuff, but you focused on diversity and ID with that, right?
Yeah, so that was for my master's work. My advisor, Dr. Wes Watson, he's a veterinary entomologist, and I was a second grad student. He had this project he was going to work on, and he wanted me to be a part of it, and I thought that was amazing. I liked beetles. Actually, when I applied here, I wanted to study either beetles or wasps, and I've always been a lifelong beetle lover. And so dung beetles were sounded really cool, and it was was working in these pastures in North Carolina. We were looking at diversity in two different regions, and the first day I went out with him to the dung to the pasture, there was a dung pad and a beetle on top, and I was like, oh yeah, look at that, I'm really far away. And by the end of it, I would have just picked that beetle off the dung pad, no problem. But tubs of dung feeding dung beetles and lots of trapping of dung beetles and making dung baits and everything. So,
can you tell us a little bit more about that? How do you make a dung bait for a trap?
Yeah. So, my project involved a bunch of different things, but the big project, my favorite part was I trapped every other week for a year and a half in the Piedmont area and the coastal plains, and trapped on a beef farm, a dairy farm, and then the dairy farm in the Piedmont. And basically, we built these pitfall traps that have a funnel at the top, and they have a raised grate. And on that raised grate, you basically clip a little bag of dung. And so what I would do is go out to the field, collect tubs of, you know, 20, 30 pounds of dung, bring it back to the lab, freeze it so that there were no insects or whatever coming out of it. And then once it thawed, I would take little paper towels and an ice cream scoop and scoop a bit of dung onto the paper towel and then wrap it up and put it in the freezer on some wax paper. And when I was ready to go out and trap, I would bring the traps and the dung out. And by the time I got out to the field, they were thawed in the car.
Right.
And put them in the ground and, you know, leave them for 24 hours and then come back and collect all the beetles.
I have a question. When the dung was in the freezer, did you have labels on those? Like, this is not ice cream, do not eat, things like that?
I didn't. But luckily, most of the people in my lab kind of knew what was going on.
They threw the poo freezer when they saw it.
Not for food. Not for human consumption.
Were you a part of the Amazon reviews by scientists recently? Like, did you have a superior poo scooper compared to others, or...?
It's good you asked that, because somebody did post an ice cream scoop, and they said they used it for the exact same thing, and I was blown away. Mine was actually one that, when my grandmother passed away, it got into my possession, and okay. I used it.
So it's an heirloom. Heirloom poop. It's an heirloom poop scoop.
It was an old school metal with the kind of crazy gear on it and everything. It worked really well, though.
That's awesome.
That's a great story.
So yeah, it was really interesting. And actually, everybody in the lab got a kick out of me using that. They'll tell that story all the time.
I like the process there where, you know, you've got a whole, before you can get out into the field, you have a whole process of getting it ready and you know, I wouldn't have expected that much effort going into getting your dung in a shape that it can be out in the traps.
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of thinking and planning about how we wanted to do it. At first, we wanted to see, you know, the most attractive dungs are actually from pigs and humans. Well, we weren't going to do human. I just wasn't going to do that. And the pig dung, we could have maybe, but we didn't, the farms or research farms, we didn't want to bring pig dung onto them. And also, we kind of wanted to see what the actual was attracted to cattle dung and not this non-existent dung on the site. So if I wanted to catch lots of beetles, I would use some kind of that kind of dung, but we were in cattle pastures, so cattle dung, and actually cattle dung specifically from each farm that we were trapping on, so that we could maybe get the, you know, the beef cattle, beef dung is actually pretty dry because they feed on a lot of the dry materials and range things. The dairy dung, of course, has a lot of silage and certain other components that make it a lot more wet.
Yeah, gooey.
Do they have any problems with treating the cows for, like, internal parasites or anything, with that affecting dung beetles trying to live on it?
Yeah, so we actually did some studies where we trapped in an area where they... So the research farm that we were doing it on wasn't using those. And actually, at the same time, Wes was developing a walk-through fly trap. And so that walks through, it's like a little car wash. And the cows walk through and get brushed by these floppy kind of flaps, and the flies fly off and then go outside. They actually also then, the patent is here with that lab. They developed a vacuum that actually sucks the flies off of the cows while they go through this thing. And it was pretty easy to train the dairy cattle. But we did trap in another site and compare it to this one that didn't use it, that were using methoprene and some other insect growth regulators. I think that's what they were using. They were using some dewormers and some horn fly control, and we were trying to see if we caught as many dung beetles in those areas.
Was there a big difference?
Yeah, so in my study in the field, it didn't seem like it affected them. There had been conflicting information on lab studies where they purposefully inoculated it with the pesticides, and we didn't see a drop from estimates about how long they should have developed and when they started using it. We didn't see a drop in the population. So it seemed, and they were getting good fly control too. So it seemed like it was not really affecting the dung beetles as much as the flies, luckily.
Oh, that's really cool. So that was your master's research, mm-hmm. and you know that's reaching back a pretty good distance in time now. I guess going into it, did you have an idea that you were interested in systematics and identification, or were you more interested in like the applied working with cows? And you said you were interested in beetles. Was it just this was a beetle project, and the systematics was secondary?
Yeah. So I've always loved identifying and looking at the diversity of insects, and that's I think why insects always grab me. I probably would have been an arachnologist if there were more jobs out there for that. But but insects are so diverse and great. And basically, with my trapping, I get to identify. I counted and identified about 90,000 specimens over my 18 months and of 30-something species. And so that was the fun part for me. I do like, it's nice to be able to add an applied component and to be able to easily tell people why it's important. But I also just like insects for what they are.
Well, the applied side's where the money is, too.
Yeah, it is. That's part of how it works, I guess. And so, yes. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, everything's human-centric, and so what can help or harm humans is really good to study. But I also, I do kind of have to admit that I like insects that don't do anything to people or anything like that.
We just have such an anthropocentric way of looking at insects, don't we? It's either they're bad or they're good, but so many of them, they just want to be alive. They're just cool. They're just the dude, except an insect.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Do you have any pets that are arthropods?
Do right now in the house have my daughter wanted a pet. Well, I have two daughters, and my older daughter wanted a pet, and somebody in the department was getting rid of some hissing cockroaches, and so I brought them home for her, and she was so happy. She loves them so much. We actually just augmented their colonies and gave my younger daughter a set, and then I also just brought back some spider beetles from a friend. He had a colony, and so I gave them a few of them, a little colony each of those. So yes, those are our friends, and you'll be glad to know. Well, I don't know if this is a good thing or not, but my daughter now, every time they see cockroaches anywhere, they're like, "Oh, that's so cute." This is Smokey Brown. We get Smokey Browns in the house all the time, and they're catching them and saying, "Oh, look how cute this is." And so they're gateway.
Well, I think. Well, I've talked about it before, but they need to do like studies on all children of entomologists because my daughter's the same way about spiders. Like right now, we have a yellow sack spider in a container that I caught it in the house, and I don't want it to die in the cold, and I don't want to let it go. So it's just I feed it.
What's its name?
Yellow sack spider.
Oh.
we didn't name it. But it's there. Yeah.
My daughters are pretty good with spiders. They like them from afar, but they respect them and they like them. And my younger daughter's always like, "Oh, look at this little spider," and all that stuff. And she is definitely not like terrified or anything. And honestly, bees are really the only thing. Well, bees in quotes, anything that's kind of wasp-like and can sting. And I think that's basically what they're worried about. And I try every time to say, "Oh, yeah, all these wasps and bees are on this plant, but look at me. I can go right next to it, and they're not going to hurt me." They don't believe me, though.
So. Aposematism works.
Yeah, it does. I'm training them to figure out the flies from the bees, though.
Yeah, that's a good lesson. That's fun. And then they got to count the wings.
Yeah, I'm training them to, you know, when they're flying, so they know exactly now. I don't know. But, yeah.
I get that. My three-year-old can tell the difference between the stink bugs and the leaf-footed bugs that come into the house now.
Yeah, we haven't had enough of them. In the house, and they know what stink bugs are. They know we haven't had any leaf-footed bugs come in, so they haven't seen got enough experience with them.
We've got a bunch of pines next to the house, so we get the western
conifer seed bug.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you like systematics, you like identification, and now you are the. I guess what's your title at NC State? What do you call yourself?
My official. Well, yeah, that's
hipster entomologist.
My official title is Extension Associate. I am a non-tenured faculty member in the Department of entomology and plant pathology. And so, but I don't know, it's hard. I call myself an entomologist, basically, and a diagnostician, because I do identifications for the plant disease and insect clinic, our diagnostic clinic here.
Okay. We were talking before we started recording. Seems like it's a little bit different between NC State and Penn State. So you've got a walk-in clinic. People can just bring in samples, and you've got, like, you're sitting at the front desk, and they just drop them off, or?
Yeah, so that can happen, and it does happen. I would say it's not regularly, but also when people already have entered the information into our system and we know that they're going to drop them off, they either send them in or they can drop them off. And then some clients come in, just, you know, they said they called somebody and they said, oh, just come to NC State here. And they come with some bag or some plant or something and say, I heard you guys were here. Can you help us out?
That's really interesting because, like, my office, I'm up on the fifth floor and I've got, in the almost year I've been here, I've got maybe 4 people that have walked in, and everything else has been sent through the mail or sent via the county extension offices. So I get very little, like, face-to-face time with clients because they just don't come in.
Is that your experience, Jody?
You get mail, like, mail? How do those specimens look? The things I've received in the mail are, like, dried up, falling apart, on tape, in a bag. So they never look good. Well,
we've got instructions on our extension website, which is what most people find when they, you know, do Insect ID Pennsylvania, and it's got instructions on there to put it in alcohol in a liquid tight jar and send it in that way. Sorry, what's that, Matt?
Yeah, that's the same with us. I mean, a lot of the extension agents are well versed in how to prepare the specimens and things, and we when we give clinic tours, we advise people how best to submit samples of different types.
Yeah. And our master gardeners here that work at the county extension offices are all trained on how to do that as well.
Our problem must be that we're the agents.
People just want to come see us, send us things, show us whatever they've got.
Well, and Michael, you're just the entomology clinic, and there's a plant pathology clinic. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so there's a plant pathology clinic. They're separate, because entomology and plant pathology are separate departments here. So they're off in a different building, and I know Sarah May that runs the clinic, like, we've met a couple times, and, you know, if she gets a sample in that's mostly insect damage or there's no fungal diseases but she sees bugs on it, she'll forward it on to me, and then I'll get the sample. And likewise, if I get something in, somebody submits a plant sample, and there's no insects, but there's some kind of obvious damage, but it might be fungal or viral or bacterial or whatever, I'll ship it over to her. But otherwise, you know, we don't have a shared space. We're not interacting on a regular basis. There's been talk about combining the clinics, but it kind of comes down to Sarah really likes being over in Plant Path, and I like being in entomology.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Basically, our clinic began as a plant pathology because of actually a specific couple tobacco diseases that happened in the 1950s, and they developed the clinic. And then in the late, I think, 70s, when my predecessor, Dave Steffen, who worked there for 38 years until I started, they basically said, well, we've got people interested in insect stuff, so let's add an entomologist. Basically, the entomologist would be in the entomology department, and the plant pathologist obviously were in plant pathology until a year or so ago that we combined. But basically, I work in the lab. I'm the only entomologist in our lab, and we have a few dedicated plant pathologists in the lab, and then a lot of the faculty, plant pathology faculty, do diagnoses for specific commodities. So if it's an arthropodic or anything, any animal other than nematodes, I do the identifications.
So is it you get mostly plant stuff then, or is it people sending in, like, because right now we're getting, I get all, obviously, no plant pests because there's nothing growing outside. It's all, you know, indoor pests, dermestids, bed bugs, that kind of stuff. Do you get, like, that kind of residential or indoor pests as well, or is it mostly plant pests?
Yes, so I would say, I just tallied it up, and actually you'll see those numbers when I come give the talk, but basically, I would say a quarter or maybe two-thirds or a third of what I get in is kind of residential, commercial buildings, human type issues, not dealing with plants, but a lot of them are ornamental plants, especially homeowner ornamentals. I would say it's kind of split pretty well. This time of year, I do get a lot more of the household, like you all probably do. But I do get some say greenhouse production is ramping up right now. And it's a little warmer, of course, here in North Carolina. So it's starting to warm up. We're seeing more activity. I got some bees and some, ground nesting solitary bee photo came in just now, the other day. And so, yeah, I get a good mix.
Ah, cool. So I guess we haven't established, how long have you been there in your position?
Yeah, so it doesn't feel like that long, but it's coming up actually March, right in the middle of March is 5 years for me.
Oh, wow. So have you seen a big turnover, and even 5 years might not be enough for this, but a big turnover from like physical specimens more towards email? Because I think about maybe half of the IDs that I do are via email and photos anymore. And obviously 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case.
So I get a lot of email images from kind of random people, like very small amount. And then Mike Wallvogel, our extension structural pest and household, he sends me a lot of referrals from PCOs and other people. So they're usually just photos and emails that I respond to. Then through our database system in the clinic, we have physical only, image only, and then both things that have images and physical samples sent in. And split, it's almost exactly 50-50 between the physical only and the image only. And so for the plant pathologist, it's a lot harder to diagnose things from images. And so they almost always have physical specimens sent in, but I can get away with some that I need. And a lot of the physical samples that have been sent in for diseases or other issues that the grower, say, doesn't know, may be an insect issue, but they didn't know it, so they just sent in the physical specimen or a physical sample.
With all these specimens that you're getting in and looking at, is it pretty much the same kind of stuff that you're seeing coming in all the time, or... is there anything weird that ever comes in that just threw you for a loop? Like, I haven't seen this before.
Oh, yeah. There have been plenty of things that have come in that I've either never seen before or it's something I know of and I've never seen a specimen or I'm really happy to get.
Tell us about one.
Let's see. What have I recently? I'm actually just right now, since it's been kind of a lull in the winter time, I'm curating a lot of specimens. To get them, I've got temporary labels on them, but I've got to get the permanent labels on them and get them up in the collection. Let's see, what was the coolest things? Let's see if recently. Every once in a while, you get some bycatch. So again, somebody who's worried about household pests or something, and they collect everything from their house. And I've gotten the weird, like reticulate beetles and like these ancient, those cupetids, which are these weird rare beetles. We actually a few years ago. Somebody wrote in and said, I was brushing my kid's hair, and I thought that this was a flea, and we had one before, and I have this sample, so they sent it in. And I was like, ooh, wow. And it's the only specimen of this species of flat bark beetle, Sylvanid, that we have in this one. It's Nasibius repandus. It's the only specimen we have now in the collection. It was collected from some kid's hair.
Is that on the collection label, combed out of hair?
It is. Yep. I've got, my lab mate brought a bug that got into his daughter's eye, and that says from lab mate, not lab mate's eye, but
from human's eye. From
human eye, yeah.
Ah, cool.
I'm trying to think of some other ones. We get a lot of really interesting, often it's bycatch. I'm trying to think of some good ones recently that we got in that were really super interesting to me.
Well, not to interrupt your thought process there, but can you explain to our listeners what you mean by bycatch?
Yeah. So basically somebody will send in, say, one of my favorite samples ever was a section of a holly tree from a neighborhood. And I forget what ultimately had happened to it, but it was severely stressed. They tried to prune it too far. It was growing all these adventitious growth, all these branches from the base. It was just like, screaming out. It was really stressed. They brought in about a 3-foot section of one of the trunks, and you know, it was only about the width of a wrist or so. But it came in, and it kind of came, they came to the door, and it smelled both awful and amazing because it was that, that smell. You know that you're going to get a lot of cool stuff on. So, you know, for the actual what happened to the plant, it was stress, and there was some, maybe there was some disease or something, but that was the pathology side. I really loved that there were like 7 different families of weird beetles that feed on fungus and decaying wood and all these little tiny beetles that nobody knows, you know, most people don't, have never heard of the name. They don't even have common names. Like Lima floids and all these like coelophid larvae and all these really weird. So that was fun. So I just collected everything I could off of that one and then gave it to the pathologist.
Well, and that kind of brings up how me and you first got in contact with each other, because we met via email the first time. I found a weird large weevil in Arkansas. It was a new record for there, and I just reached out because I wanted to use some of your photos in my paper.
Yeah.
And it turned out that you also happened to have some specimens and some information, so we ended up working that up as a joint co-authorship together.
Yeah, that was a really cool sample, mostly because that was when I first got into the clinic, and I was really green. I remember now identifying a beetle that's super common that nowadays I would have no problem identifying, and I think I misidentified. It was one of my first samples, and it's just like experience is a major thing for being a diagnostician. It doesn't matter how many things you've seen virtually. And so they also had, when I came into the lab, they had this section from that arborvitae tree, and it was this tree that was growing outside of a school, and a bunch of them were just dying one after another. And they peeled the bark of this section. They sent a foot section. I still have it debarked up above my desk. And I pulled some bark, and I saw, oh wow, all these galleries, all these like tunnels, basically. And then there was a larva of a weevil. And I was like, ooh, a weevil in this. And I kind of figured out what it might be, but all I had was larvae. And so I kept it in a bucket for a month or two, waiting for the adults to come off and hoping that I could actually rear something. And I did. You saw some of the specimens and got photos of the larvae, kept preserved some of the larvae, got photos of the pupae, and the rest is history.
I like these stories. I like hearing about your excitement. It makes us feel less nerdy.
You guys are perfectly normal.
Like today I brought in some millipedes for Jonathan in a Thai food takeout container that I washed out and I had it in my bedroom last night because I didn't want them to get cold. And I was like, I can't let, you know, my husband see these at the side of my bed.
Really? Yeah.
I can't have anyone pack those for lunch. Yeah, see? And that's the thing. It's like,
well, my wife, she's an entomologist. She's an entomologist.
What?
Although she's, yes, we met in grad school here. But she is not really an insect lover, per se. She more got into the plant protection kind of thing. And now she works for the USDA and does something and stuff that isn't really... It has some entomology components, but not directly. So she puts up with it, and she understands it much more, I think, than the average spouse, I think. But yeah, no, the containers, those are great. I have a bunch of the empty Chinese food containers that are great for sorting and for, I have some with, they were peeling bark for emerald ash borer killed ashes, and they were looking for parasitoids, and I'm trying to rear some in the lab and see what they are, if they're anything new.
Don't you love how when we see a container, like Tupperware, to-go container, anything, it's like, it's always, would that be a good container for bugs? Like, the reason I kept those containers is because I thought I would bring some pin specimens in for tomorrow's class.
That would be a good one.
Well, I use that container for your millipedes, but I was like, I could put some styrofoam there, you know,
You need more, yeah. It sounds like.
A good excuse to go get Thai food.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? Most of the good Tupperware that I have at my house, I've actually brought home from the lab. People have brought, like, their bugs in it. And I'm like, do you want this container? And they're like, no. And I'm like, this is great Tupperware. They're like, there was a bug in there. And I'm like, yes, score. So.
I could steal a lot of people's identities because I get pill bottles and they leave everything on there.
Oh. Yeah, no, I thought about that one time, too. I was like, wait a minute. They're just sending these pill bottles with everything on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have They've changed. The Chinese food place that I eat at now has black containers instead of the white ones. And the white ones are perfect for sorting stuff. And black ones is just, I think that's why they changed it, maybe.
They heard about you.
Most of the Tupperware I've got at home, maybe not most, but at least half, they've got, you know, holes in the top of the container because I was rearing something in them at some point and needed to breathe. Now they're fine for most things, but you can't store liquid in them.
Right, so they're not airtight. Well, that's different. Then that's
not anymore.
So then you don't get, like, when people walk in, have they brought you very strange containers? Like, I think we've had, like, a bowl of popcorn that came in, like, just open. And I've had bed bug specimens come in a container of, like, Tropicana orange juice, like a giant container.
So let's see. What are the weirdest containers to get? You probably have gotten these, too. Like, contact lens cases?
Ooh, no. Yeah. Haven't had that one.
Yeah, the screw top with the, you know, the... store them in the liquid. Those little flat ones that look like the little glasses or whatever. I don't know how to describe them. Yeah, there'll be some kind of alcohol and some kind of debris in them usually. and let's see, what a baby food container jars is pretty popular. Yep. Yeah, but yeah, prescription pill jars are like the most popular, I think.
Which is a shame because I've found that they leak a lot.
Yeah, if they're not the ones with the little soft plastic inside of the top, then that's pretty terrible.
So, we're not quite running out of time, but I'm moving on just a little bit.
Course.
You know, you get all these insects in, and your ID, your job's mostly ID'd, but do you ever have time, or can you make that work with research in any kind of way? Do you still get to do that kind of stuff if you want?
Yeah, so most of my research is nowadays is basically collaborations with other people where there's some kind of identification component for me or some kind of biological information component. So, you know, if people have a large amount of specimens that are from, say, an ecological project and they're having trouble IDing a bunch, I'll take on that project to IDing a lot of things. One of my most recent ones was a really crazy one, a Pacha Seltman out at UC Santa Barbara on Palmyra Atoll on the weird two square mile island, and it's a little nature preserve, and they've had a series of surveys over the years, and they ramped up the trapping, and this student is actually really interested in the flies and ecology and all that stuff, and they wanted me to help identify those flies, so they sent me, you know, 100 or so specimens of these weird, you know, these flies from the middle of the Pacific. And so that was a lot of fun. I was worried I wasn't going to be able to get much done with IDs because of that part of the world, but there's actually a lot of literature out there for, say, Hawaii and some of the Pacific areas. So I was actually even able to get some things done to species, which was really cool.
Oh, neat. And, you know, I saw your talk at ESA. You've been doing a lot with the home surveys too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, our big study in North Carolina of the 50 homes was a few years ago. Actually, it was done in 2012, and the paper came out in 2016. We have included now a smaller subset of samples from around the world, basically. And those were pretty fun to look at. And that was my talk at ESA. It was kind of more to the systematists and the biodiversity people about the fun bycatch, things we don't think are necessarily home associates, but that are really interesting to just kind of basic entomologists.
So I just diving into that for just a minute for people listening, what did you find? Was there a lot of insects or a lot of diversity in homes?
Yeah, so there was a lot of diversity. We found an average of about 90 species in each home, and we were looking at morpho species because a lot of the specimens were either damaged or very difficult to identify. But this is basically a good portion of it were things that kind of were flying into homes and getting stuck there and dying. We definitely got a huge amount of specimens and species that are very closely associated with homes. And in fact, when you look at what the types of organisms that were in the majority of homes, they're very typical, like cobweb spiders and carp beetles and book lice. Ants, which are not living in homes necessarily, but very frequent visitors of homes.
Flies was your biggest. It's my favorite pie chart of all time. I just have to tell you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I I look at that pie chart a lot. I refer to that study a lot because, you know, I'm always dealing with homeowners and, you know, when they think, oh, this is this normal? What is this? Is it, you know, coming after me? I'm like, this is very normal to have in homes. You know, these things indicate moisture or this indicates this, but this is very common. And then I'll say, you know, they did this survey, researchers of, you know, 50 homes in the Raleigh area. And, you know, this is what they found. It's completely normal. Your house is not dirty. You know, might not necessarily be about that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And we, yeah, so the diversity, as far as diversity it applies, so that chart is actually, it's a little, basically if you take the average number of species per room and then average that across all rooms, that's basically that chart, that pie graph. So a typical room is going to have the most diversity in flies, then spiders and beetles and mostly ants and other wasps and things like that, and then kind of going down from there. There were a lot of flies, but a lot of them were very tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And when after we did collect them, it was really funny. So we'd go in and we'd label each vial for each room, and we'd come back at the end and we'd show the people there, you know, what we caught. It would be like these dozen vials that were, you know, filled halfway with insect specimens or arthropod specimens. And they were a little freaked out. And they were like, you found that all in my house? I just had the cleaner come yesterday. It's like, I don't know how you did that. Then we said, well, actually, this is pretty typical.
Mm-hmm.
When we're given interviews before that, people ask about how, you know, how would you quantify that to the actual, you know, listener, viewer? And I said, you know, it's about a shot glass full of specimens, usually. And mm-hmm. It's not a lot. So you got 100 species, but they don't fill a shot glass, basically.
You know, I've tried to do that at my own home, but my daughter got bored.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, you get into a little zen-like state, and, you know, the craziest one was I had to do one all by myself, and it was one of the largest of the homes, so it took me 7 hours to do that one home by myself.
Those are very understanding homeowners.
Yeah, no, they were really curious. It was the owner was there for the day, and she was really curious. And that was actually a really cool one because that was what I dubbed the spitting spider home. That had the most spitting spiders of all the homes and one of my favorite groups of animals on Earth.
That would be a cool house to have. I would put that on my Zillow listing if I were selling that house.
Yeah, she was all right with that. She actually liked it, and she was not afraid or worried about them.
I like meeting people like that.
Yeah, since we had volunteers, most everybody was pretty interested. And there are some people that were kind of indifferent, but a lot of people were really just curious, and they were really just happy to be part of this kind of project.
Yeah, well, that's really cool. Well, I love following you on Twitter, and I'm glad we met, and it's really, really cool that you could be on Arthropod with us today.
Well, I appreciate it. I really enjoyed this, and I love following all of you guys on Twitter, too, and watching, and hoping to post more photos soon, because I do love taking the photos of weird things that nobody ever thinks to photograph too. So look out for them.
How can people find you on Twitter, Matt?
I am Bertone Maya. It's Bertone Maya, which is the Greek for fly. That's why everything has Maya in it. But I do like beetles and other stuff. So,
but your picture online is a fly.
Yeah, of course. So this is what I have to say about that stuff is that, you know, just like a hipster entomologist, I think flies are the bourbon, they are the acquired taste of the IPA of insects. Like once you get into them, you're like, wow, flies are the most craziest insects on Earth. Beetles are like they're like Hawaiian punch of vodka, I guess. They're like really easy to drink. And it's satisfying in some way, but it's also not very, you know, everybody can get into beetles, but flies are the hard one to get into.
We need to make this a thing.
Like beetles are like the fountain soda. Like you just go up and, you know, fill and get refills.
So everybody else can have the butterflies and dragonflies. I'll take the weird little flies and weird little beetles.
Well, thanks for being on. We're going to put in our show notes the spot where they can find you on Twitter. You can find the rest of us on Twitter. I'm at @JLarson_UNL.
I'm at @JodyBugsMe_UNL.
I'm @Marla36.
And if you want to find the show, you can always find the blog at arthro-pod.com. www.blogspot.com, and you can leave us a comment on there, give us some ideas for future shows. And you can find us on iTunes and on Stitcher or many of your other favorite podcatcher apps. So definitely check us out there. And thanks for tuning in to another exciting episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.